Hello, and welcome to this episode of Bite Back Chats Books with me, Nell Whisker. On today's episode, I'll be speaking with Pete Carville. Pete is a reporter, writer, and editor for the UK's Trade Press. He first put on boxing gloves 20 years ago and has only recently taken them off. His latest book, Death of a Boxer, explores the psychology of those who choose to fight and what draws them towards this most dangerous of pursuits. In this episode, we discuss Pete's own experience in the sport and some of the major fights he's been ringside for before looking more deeply at the boxing community. Hi, Pete. Great to have you on this episode of Bite Back Chats Books.
Hi, Nell. It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me along.
And we're really excited to talk about your new book, Death of a Boxer. Why is it called that?
Well, the title itself is I would say a homage, but it's a reference to a famous story by W.C. Hinds from about 1930 called "Death of a Racehorse," which was about a horse breaking its leg at a race in New York, I think it was, and it's known as one of the most influential sports stories of the 20th century. So that's obvious a reference there. But we also just when we I was mulling over a handful of titles for the book, and then I just wrote "Death of a Boxer" down, and I just thought, oh, that's it. And then it was really no question at that point that it was going to be the title of the book.
And do you think that part of it is that you feel boxing is a dying sport? Is that a factor?
No, I don't think boxing's a dying sport. I think boxing is really not a dying sport. I mean, it's certainly more niche than it was. But the fact that if you look at places like Saudi Arabia, they're investing hundreds of millions into putting on boxing events. So it's still a popular sport around the world. But boxing's the only sport really death is always on the table. You
Yes.
know, it is always a possibility that someone may die. I mean, if you look at things like motorsport back in the 60s, it was the same. Everyone expected someone to die racing in Formula One during the 60s, and eventually became safer. But just the nature of boxing itself is that you can't eliminate all the risk. You can try and minimize it, you can try and make it safer, but ultimately that's always going to be a factor that's there. And someone said to me once is that if you can't write well about boxing, then you just can't write at all, because there's everything in that ring. There's life, it's death, it's violence, it's love. There's effort, there's sacrifice, and the stakes are always so high that if you, as I write in the book as well, like if you're on your way up and you lose one fight, then you go back down three or four rungs on the ladder. You know, it might take you four or five fights to get back to that stage you're at, and that's if you get back there at all.
And in the writing process for this book, where did your research take you?
So I've traveled a lot for this book. So originally, when I was speaking with Bite Back about doing the book, I just wanted to write about the title person, Mike Tattle, who died in 2016. And the reason I sort of settled on Mike Tattle was that after he passed, there was a what's called as a fatal accident inquiry in Scotland, and they released a very, very big report on the run up to the fight and what had happened, and somewhat the aftermath as well. And I really was looking at Jon Krakauer's Into the Wild, and I thought, wow, we have a similar story of a young man who, in seeking something bigger than himself, unfortunately flies a little bit too close to the sun. And I thought, well, that's the story there. And then I took it to the guys at Bite Back, and they said, well, it's a good story in itself, but it needs to be a little bit more universal. So I said, okay, let me come back and think about it a little bit. And so I went back to the guys and I said, hey, this is what I think. Is I think I can talk to a person in this position and a person in that position, and a person who's doing this and a person who's doing that, and a person who's maybe at this point in their career. And they said, okay. And I said, okay, well, how am I going to do this? And I thought, well, I don't know. So originally I thought, well, I'll look around, and I started making contact with people that were in these positions that I thought would work well in the book. And then eventually that just took me everywhere. I was it's kind of starts in Spain. So I did a magazine story from Spain a couple of years ago. That's now a chapter in the book. It's been expanded by it's been I've doubled it in length for the book. So I was in Spain. I was in Sweden with Erik Skoglund, a former European champion. I was in the States. I was in Poland. I think I've written it from about six different trips to the UK. So there's There's been a lot. I mean, in the States, I was in New York, I was in Boston, and then I was in rural Pennsylvania, very rural Pennsylvania.
Okay.
In probably one of the most interesting places I've ever been.
Really?
Well, originally, so when I was doing writing the chapter Ghosts, I wanted to speak to an ex-fighter who was seeing the after effects of their career. And there
Yeah.
was a famous boxer called Mickey Ward who lives near Boston. And I was trying to get in touch with Mickey Ward for months and months and months, and I never got anywhere. And then eventually, just out of desperation, I turned to the Concussion Legacy Foundation and I said to them, hey, I'm trying to find someone in this particular position. Do you know anyone that would, think would talk to me for the book? And they said, well, we have this guy called Alan Bleiweiss who lives in rural Pennsylvania, and here's his email. He'd love to speak to you. So I emailed him, and he emailed me back within an hour, and he said, come to Pennsylvania. And so I turned up in Pennsylvania, and Alan, he's a lovely fella. He's recently found God in the last couple of years, and it's absolutely turned his life around. But he's working now out of a gym called the Five Stones, and the gym is basically part fighting gym and part church. And
Okay.
these guys are very, very serious about fighting, and they're very, very serious about church, and they're all lovely people. And it was a privilege and an honor to go down there and spend a couple of days with them.
What an interesting combination. Were you astonished by that, or is that a regular thing, religion and boxing?
It's a regular thing, I think, and I
Yeah.
had some thoughts on it that may be complete rubbish, but what I think is that there's a similar thing is you work hard for a very, very, very long time, and then
Yeah.
there's a big payoff at the end. And I think that's kind of where religion and boxing meet. You spend years and
Interesting.
years and years training for a title shot, and then you get it and make some money. And in religion, you spend your whole life being good, and then hopefully you go to heaven at the end.
Okay, wow, interesting. That's a good, I like that. And I mean, let's talk a bit about how your personal relationship with boxing. You were a boxer,
Sure.
you are no longer in the ring. Is that correct to say?
It's mostly correct, yeah. So I
Yeah.
never competed. I have fairly bad eyesight that kept me out of it.
Okay.
But I trained fairly heavily for about 15 years. So I was at one point very, very fit, and I was fairly good at the basics. I had a fairly good. I'm a southpaw naturally, so my most powerful punch was my left hand. So I had fairly good power, and I was had fairly good legs as well. Like I was really good at balance of my legs. But I didn't have much of the things that you kind of really need, like a defense or the
Okay.
ability to take a punch or the ability to take a punch to the body. But I loved it, and I did it for 15 years. I probably sparred 500, 600 rounds over that time, and I stopped doing it when I hit 30 was about 10 years in, and I said, I need to start tapering down and find something else to do. And everyone that I trained with at the same time, they all started drifting out of it. They all said, "Look, injuries are starting to build up. We have to be sensible." Because all my friends, they had day jobs. They were architects or teachers or
Right.
film editors, and they said, "The damage is building up. We can't. It's fun now, but it's starting to hurt more and more." So
Yeah.
everyone started drifting away after 30. And then when I got to 34, I was 30 pounds over my fighting weight. And I was in a gym in Berlin, and I'd already said to myself, look, I'm doing this for another 6 months, and then I'm just going to stop my 35th birthday. So this is now 7 years ago because I'm 42. And I was in the gym, and I didn't want to be there. And I got in the ring to spar because someone said, let's spar. And I said, okay. And I didn't want to do it, but I didn't want to say no. And I got in the ring, and I did about a minute. And this guy just was, who was always better than me, started peppering me up with jabs. I dropped my left hand, thinking, right, I'm going to bring him in, and then I'm just going to come on over the top. And I dropped it, and then he hit me just on the cheekbone, and my
Oh.
legs went.
Oh God.
I always
Yeah.
say if it had been an inch lower, I'd have been on the floor. And conversely, it's like the proudest moment I have from my very awful boxing career is that when he hit me, my legs went, I just went, yeah, come on, we'll keep on going. And he was like, no, dude, you can't take another one, because if it hit me again, like I would have been
Yeah.
unconscious. So that was it. But when people ask, I say, look, I knew the basics. I was fairly good at them. But comparing me to someone who does it professionally or does it at a high level is like comparing a taxi driver to Lewis Hamilton. I knew the basics. I knew what the steering wheel was. I
Yeah.
knew what the pedals did. But that was it. And I've trained up close with guys who have been very good, European champions, British champions. I don't think I
Yeah.
ever trained alongside a world champion. they were just miles ahead of what I could do.
Mm.
And it's just, yeah. So it
Yeah.
wasn't, I always say to people, I'm the only person that's ever been knocked out while shadow boxing, you know?
And you clearly love the sport, and in the book you say the boxing is full of lessons. I suppose you've just really spoken about one of the lessons there. Were there any other bigger lessons that carry into everyday life?
Yeah, look, everything I got from the sport. So I don't ever want to diminish its importance in what I've done.
Mm.
As you can tell, I don't come from a middle class background. You know, I was born in Runcorn, and I'm very, very Scouse. So for me to get from where I was, I've had a fairly sort of middling to fairly successful career. But the reason, the difference between me. So the thing that got me to where I am in my career now was the fact that I had this work ethic instilled in me by boxing, which is you turn up every day and you put your best effort in, and then eventually things will start to work for you. And it's weird. I found it when I was started boxing at 19. When I started, I was hopeless. I literally I would fall over without being punched. I had no balance.
Mm.
And then after 6 months, I really started to get a few things down, and then within a year, I was showing people the basics. And that lesson of look, if you just turn up every day and put the work in, then eventually, you know, that's worth more than actually just being naturally good at something.
And Andy McGrath has described the book as an exploration of modern masculinity and an ode to the sweet science of boxing. I love those two phrases about that. How do you feel about the modern masculinity element? Do you think there's been a shift in the way boxing is viewed and masculinity?
No, I think it's been a good way to instill some sort of fairly old school values in people. Boxing gyms are the most egalitarian places in the world, and they're also the places where values such as honor are still practiced. You know,
Mm.
we I think I write in the book there's a story about a bodybuilder that gets beaten up in the gym in Berlin about 12 years ago. And I write it was a difference between the guy who beat him up and the guy who and that guy was that one guy who trained as a fighter. And the backstory is, and I hope not ruining too much of the book here, is that the bodybuilder in question, the reason that the kickboxer beat him up was the bodybuilder had beaten up two girls the weekend before. That the kickboxer knew, and he was waiting for this guy to turn up. And that's very much a value that you see in boxing gyms, right or wrongly. Like boxing guys, martial arts guys, they hate men who are bullies, who pick on women and
Okay.
children. And it's just maybe it's not the best example, most socially acceptable example of masculinity, but I'm of the opinion that boxing is very good to show young boys how to be good men.
Do you think that, I mean, looking at the history of boxing, do you think that there's been a social growth around boxing, or is it stayed in one particular class element?
There's always been a class element to it. It's always been working class and underclass kids that have gone into boxing. No one ever boxed because they weren't hungry. What you would see now is that has. Industry has changed as the workforce has changed. We've moved out of primary and secondary industry into a more
Mm.
service industry. It's way more frowned upon. If you go back into the 50s and 60s when people became a professional boxer, that was a fairly safe job compared to the alternatives of mining or working on the docks or working on the railroads. Now that we're largely like an office-based economy, it's way more socially acceptable, particularly now that we know more about the risks as well.
Okay. And then I want to talk a bit more about all the fights and fighters that are in the book. You
Sure.
go into quite a few in detail, which is, it feels like you're on the ringside, which is great. There was one that interests me. It was more about the home and away element of a fight and how the crowd can sway it with the Brian Rose in Madrid. Can you just tell us a bit about that fight?
Sure. So that was originally a magazine piece for Boxing News, and it's the one that's I expanded. I think I
Yeah.
doubled it in length to go in the but and it. Obviously, the original piece was just about them fighting Madrid. I followed up later on for the book. Brian had one more
Sure.
fight in Germany before retiring.
Yeah.
But that came about was so Brian was fighting a guy called Sergio Martinez from Argentina, and Martinez lives in Madrid. He's a national hero. in Spain, and he's the former middleweight champion of the world, one of the all-time greats, you know, really one of the all-time greats. And I saw the fight announced in September 2018. No, it would have been later, that September 21, I think it was. I saw the fight announced, and it's like I would crawl to Madrid to watch that fight. You know, I would go on my hands and knees to Madrid to watch that fight. And then I emailed the Boxing News, who I'd written a couple of pieces before, and I said, look, is this something that you're interested in, if I can get to Madrid? And they said, yeah, because it's Martinez and it's a British fighter, and that's definitely what we want. And so, and this is where boxing people, I think, are different to anywhere around the world. I reached out to Brian, I think it was through Twitter originally. And I just reached out to him through Twitter, sent him a message and said, hey, you know, Box News want me to write a piece on you. Can I come and be with you in the dressing room in Madrid before you go out to fight Sergio Martinez? And Brian emailed back a week or so later and he said, yeah, that's great. And you don't get that access. You couldn't do that with, say, Everton Football Club or Manchester United. You couldn't email the captain and say, hey, can I come and sit in the changing room? You would, yeah, it's just not going to happen. Brian said, yeah. So I turned up to Madrid, and I turned up to this bull ring in southern Madrid in a small town called Valdemoro on the outskirts. And I got my pass and I just walked into the changing room with all the fighters, and Brian was there. And Brian was there with his coach. He had someone from the British Board of Boxing Control with him just to keep an eye on what was going on. And I just sat and I made notes and I recorded and I took pictures. And what struck me about Brian was how polite he was, and how gracious he was with everybody. Now, in the story in the book, you see all the time he's saying thank you to people. They bring him some gloves. He says thank you. They bring him some water. He says thank you. Even when he's getting his eye stitched at the end, because he has this huge cut over his eye, and he's lying on his back on a metal table in the back of a bullring. And they're stitching him, I think, without anaesthetic because adrenaline's still going.
Yeah.
And he's still saying thank you to the medics doing it. And he was just, and I said he was a lovely fella. And you know, I spoke to him a little bit last week just to thank him again for being in the book. And I think he's thinking about making a comeback now. So maybe there might be another chapter.
Oh, great.
If we do a special edition or something next year.
And what was the crowd's role in that fight, especially? I mean, he was against a certain opponent. Was he expected to win? What was the prediction for that?
Well, the prediction was that Martinez was going to beat him. Essentially, Brian was there to fill a role. So Brian went in wanting to win. But he must know that at that stage of his career and the trajectory that he was on and the trajectory that Sergio Martinez was on, that he was there basically to put up a good fight but ultimately lose, which is what he did. But he boxed. I'm not going to say he won because I didn't score it round by round. I'm not going to say he won, but I would say it's very notable that in the couple of fights that Martinez had since, I think he's had two or three fights, he's not fought anyone with a record close to Brian's, because he came very close that night to losing. But this is boxing. It's not a sport. It's show business with blood. Like, Brian was there to fill a role. I don't think Brian really cared about the crowd, because he's fought in front of hostile crowds before. But I've never been in that position, but I'm going to say that it's probably doesn't help when you have 3,000 people cheering against you.
Yeah, I can imagine. It sounds pretty electric in there. And I wondered, I mean, you talk about a lot of the different fights. Are there any fights that you wish you would have been at that in history?
Oh, yeah. So I definitely would have liked to have been at the 1975 Thrill in Manila between Ali and Frazier, just because everyone who's ever seen that fight on tape wants to be at that fight. There's certain levels of fights. There's like, there's good fights, very good fights, great fights, classic fights. And then the level all by itself is the Thrill in Manila. Absolutely brutal. In terms of story, for the book, what I would have liked to have done, and it just wasn't going to happen, was I would have liked to have been at Roy Jones's fight against Enzo Macronelli in Russia, because that really, you had one guy who was basically, both guys were kind of finished at that point and they were on two different trajectories, and Enzo Macronelli turned up and had the upset. And from what I've heard since, is that because it was in Russia and there was a lot of Russian money behind the fight, Macronelli and his team were chased through the Russian were chased through the Moscow streets in a taxi by Russian gangsters afterwards. Yeah.
Wow.
If you watch the unedited the full version that fight from Russian TV, you'll see that there's a motorcycle gang called the Night Wolves, and they
Okay.
were providing a lot of security for the fighters
Yeah.
that night. And they are a very, very nasty bunch of people.
Oh God, yeah, that would have been good
But
content for the book. That would have been great,
it would have
yeah.
been a fantastic story, but yeah, unfortunately it just wasn't going to happen.
Yeah. And then I want to talk a bit about the future of boxing. I mean, you've hung up your gloves, but how do you feel the sport will continue in the next few decades?
Yeah, boxing's been dying since the 1960s. It was fairly popular in Germany when I moved over here about 10 years ago,
Yeah.
and it seems to have died off. In the UK, it's still huge. Saudi Arabia is coming in now, so boxing's following the money as it always did. It'll exist in one form or another. It always does. Japan, go back 5 years ago, Japan was not a huge boxing country, and now they have a fighter called Naoya Inoue, and he's selling out 60,000 seat stadiums in Tokyo. So it'll survive. Men
Yeah.
just fight, men fight, that's it. And there'll always be someone that wants to watch them. There's a theory I read once that you can have like a basketball game on the corner of a street anywhere, and people will be watching it. But as soon as a fight breaks out on the other street, everyone's going to walk over and watch that instead.
Yeah.
It's fairly primal. I
Yeah.
keep giving up on it, and then I keep coming back to it. I say, I'm quit. I'm not. That's it. I'm going to move on. I'm going to do something else, and then I'll hear there's a world title fight in Hamburg, and I'll go, I think I'm free that weekend.
Yeah. I suppose it all comes back to that kind of dual element. I mean, the idea of Aeneas and Turnus and the classic Roman stories, or even like pistols at dawn element. I mean, it's always quite exciting in that way. And I think your book really conveys that, but it is, as you say, love letters to boxing. And thank you so much for coming on the podcast today, Pete. And yeah.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Bite Back podcast. Death of a Boxer is out now. Head to the Bite Back website to use exclusive 20% off code BOX20. And do get in touch with us on Twitter with your questions or queries at Bite Back Pub.